Welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we are talking about Late Night with the Devil. And joining me is filmmaker Nick Roth, who has a new movie out right now called Hanky Panky. It's coming out this weekend, and I'm really excited to watch it. It sounds absolutely crazy. We'll talk a little bit about his movie, too, after the conversation about Late Night with the Devil. Before we get into it, I do want to remind you, as always, to make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Piecing Pod, and don't forget to join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show. Also, I want to tell you that we do have a Patreon, the Produced by David Rosen Patreon, where I post bonus and advanced content from Piecing It Together, Awesome Movie Year, and from my music career. I've also been posting some exclusive video versions of some of the episodes of this podcast on the Patreon. The main podcast will always be audio only, but if you want to watch us talk about these movies and what might have inspired them, some episodes will be on the Patreon. So if you want to support us, it is appreciated. You can check it out, patreon.com/bydavidrosen. Lots of great stuff to check out there. And with that said, let's get into this conversation about Late Night with the Devil. All right, Nick Roth is with me to talk about Late Night with the Devil. Nick, how's it going?
Hi, going great.
I feel like we're doing a late night talk show right now, and you're my guest. This is so fun.
I'm going to try not to summon any demons if I can help it.
If it happens, it happens. Maybe I'll get a little spike in downloads if that happens. But, you know, it's all good. Yeah, that's true. Nick, it's your first time on the show. Tell people a little about yourself.
So I'm primarily a screenwriter and a TV writer. I wrote on a TV show called American Housewife, but I'm sort of mostly focused on screenwriting right now, and I have this new movie that I somehow, which is also a crazy, very different vibe than Late Night with the Devil, but also sort of has a toe of in the horror world.
Yeah.
Hanky Panky. So I'm like mostly just focused on releasing a movie. Turns out that's like as much work or more work than making a movie.
Yeah. And then once it's out, you gotta go talk about it a bunch, and you gotta
you finish the movie, you're like and then you're like, oh wait, no, I have to, it's more work now, and it's slightly less fun than like being on set and making a movie.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm glad we're talking about Late Night with the Devil. I wasn't even 100% sure if I'd do an episode on this one, but it is unique, and you know, I did come up with a lot of puzzle pieces, honestly, for this one.
Oh, yeah?
But
good.
But yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of angles to go from. But at the same time, I was just, you know, it kind of came, and everybody talked about it for like this quick minute, and then the AI thing kind of took over the conversation. And like,
yeah,
I feel like we have to go on a little bit of a tangent on that. You being a filmmaker yourself, me being a composer, like we can't like ignore that. I mean, what are your thoughts on the use of AI in this, and you know, the bad, the good, any of it?
I wanted to deep dive this more, but so my understanding, so maybe you can clarify this for me. They used some generative AI to make still images that are in the film.
Yes, like, those little transitions, like when they're going to commercial, when they like have like, you know, a still image, like we're coming back to Night Owls after these messages.
Oh, those little like interstitial cards.
Exactly. That's it. That's literally it. It's the craziest, like almost gotcha kind of thing, because it's like, it's nothing. It's literally nothing.
I could have made those they look like someone made them in Photoshop.
Exactly. But at the same time, it's that whole give an inch, take a mile thing. If we're cool with this, the next thing you know, the whole score is done by, you know, AI instead of hiring someone like me. The whole screenplay is done instead of hiring somebody like you. I do think it's too damn difficult of a conversation to have in, you know, 10-15 minutes. I have so much trouble with this whole thing.
It's very complicated, and I think it's worth like just taking a moment to be like, okay, so AI means a lot of different things. There's a lot of AI that gets used in a lot of different ways. Like you kind of have to be case by case about it, and rather than just being like, here they used AI or here they didn't, it's like, well, okay, like if you're using Adobe Premiere Pro and there's like the auto set levels in your color correcting, like, well, okay, that's technically AI, but like you're, that's not, no one is upset about that. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many things that, okay, so it's like, where do we draw the line of like, hey, don't do this? And I guess it's like, with this, it seems like people were like, well, you should pay graphic designers or someone on your post team to just make these. And it seems like you used, look, the real issue with generative AI in my mind is that, okay, so whose actual art got basically plagiarized to make that art?
That's a whole other part of the equation too.
That's the only part of this equation that I'm actually, I would be concerned about in this case, which is that, okay, like use the tools. But are these tools that, because many of them are, and I don't know which ones they used, but like that intentionally mask what the data set was that they like mined in order to then reproduce this content? Because then there might be people whose work, there are human beings whose work is being infringed upon. And I would be, it's very hard to track. Like a lot of these generative AI platforms, the problem is that they you know, scrape a bunch of material, but, and then intentionally don't keep track of what they've scraped and how they've scraped it and how you end up with it. So it's like, maybe they just used somebody's work. Like they probably did and didn't, like that's a problem. You shouldn't do that.
I'm picturing the project one day down the road that scrapes Hanky Panky as its AI data, and then what that looks like. Like
honestly,
the photocopy of the photocopy. You know,
I can't wait. That would be. I hope someone accidentally has like a napkin having an orgasm in their completely serious rom com or something down the line because their AI was like, "What's this hanky? Oh, that's got a hanky in it."
Yeah. This will work. All right, we'll talk about Hanky Panky some more later. Let's get on to some puzzle pieces for Late Night with the Devil. You are the guest. What do you got first?
Okay, so first of all, I just want to say this was harder than I thought it was going to be. And like, okay, so I'm also an adjunct professor of film. Like I spend a lot of time talking about movies and thinking about this. So like I kind of came into this being like, this is, I'm going to be a ringer on this show. Like I'll go in, I'll be able to nail this. I felt like this was very hard. I just saw the movie last night. So I'm going to try to do my best. I only have a couple that I'm really confident about as being like, they're going to make me sound smart that I thought of this one, because there's some that are so obvious. So like, what do you think? Should I start with my best or start with the most obvious?
Well, I, you know, mine are also a big mix of the very, very obvious to the maybe a little bit of a deeper cut. So I feel like you go either way. Maybe let's go to, let's get a smart one out there for, let's get one where you're like,
that
oh
was,
yeah,
I
came up with this. This is me. This is, I'm good.
Okay, then let's start with David Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Nice.
Which I think is like not necessarily the first thing that leaps into your mind with this movie, but there is a lot that I think is sort of between a little bit of the body horror, which like some of those worms coming out that feel very Cronenberg-y. And, and then really what I'm thinking of is the way that the film, we can do spoilers, right?
Because we're like, spoil away. Yeah.
The way that the film starts to, towards the end especially, blur what's real and what's not real. And sort of mess with the audience and like, what really happened? What happened? Like, are the cameras telling the truth or not? To me, that feels very much in line with a lot of Cronenberg films, Existenz, but especially Videodrome, where it's like, this is what happens. Like, we end up, it's the media itself that are making it unclear whether Max Wren is hallucinating this stuff, whether he is sort of being brainwashed into doing it. It feels like the movie gets sort of increasingly Videodrome-y, and it's like mobilization of hallucination for like horror purposes, and we don't know what reality we're in. So it feels very, very, there's definitely one puzzle piece here that I think belongs to Cronenberg. And I think Videodrome is the one that leaps to my mind.
I think that's a great one. And I didn't think of it, so I'm glad you brought it up here. And it also kind of makes you think about, so if this movie, Late Night with the Devil, is being presented in a way where they're, you know, trying to act like it is a, you know, an actual show that happened, you know,
right.
And what did people watching this think, you know? And when you think of the effects of, you know, everything that happens in Videodrome, you kind of get maybe a little bit of a point of view of, you know, how crazy that is to see this stuff unfold on television. And and then I love, you know, bringing in the body horror element. Some of that stuff was absolutely disgusting, and I'm sure Cronenberg would love all that stuff in here. So that's a good one. I'm glad you brought it in here.
Yeah, and some of it, actually, I would just to add, like, there's a couple shots that I think, like, there's a moment where it seems like Abraxas or the devil or whatever it is sort of coming out of the screen.
Sure.
That seems
to
like like pressing up against the sort of static, like that is almost shot for shot out of the moment in Videodrome where I think it's Nikki is like, it's Debbie Harry as Nikki is sort of like bursting out of the screen, right? So it feels like these are very much of like looking at late 70s television media and screens and broadcast and like that kind of electronics and like and making that into body horror. So
sure, absolutely. This is also a movie that clearly is being made by lovers of horror, and what horror lover doesn't love Cronenberg? So
yeah,
you know, that's in the DNA right there. So I'm going to go with an obvious one for my first one, one that a lot of people have made this comparison. I'm throwing it out there because I just watched it for the first time because of the comparisons that have been made to this, and that is Ghost Watch, which...
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's a really cool thing that it was this film on, I believe, BBC TV that was made to look like an actual TV special of ghost hunters going to investigate a possession, and people thought it was, 100% real, and it scared the shit out of people. Personally speaking, to watch it with that understanding, it kind of takes some of the oomph out of it, but sure. It's still very effectively made and really feels both like an actual television show, which I think Late Night with the Devil does a great job of, approximating, those shows of the 70s, and also of being these ghost hunting shows, which I'm not like a big fan of those shows, but I have seen a lot of them with my wife who loves those kinds of things. And watching these things unfold in a way where it's usually presented as real, but then you're watching a movie here, so it's not real, but it's being presented in the movie as if it's real. It just adds those layers and layers of meta-ness to it all. And Ghostwatch, I know it's like a beloved cult classic at this point. I think it's like a very clear inspiration on what they're trying to do with Late Night with the Devil.
That's great. I'm glad you went that way, because I don't have a lot of that sort of like plays with that mockumentary form. Puzzle piece stuff.
Right on.
And I really appreciate the way that the film like doesn't shy away from making references that are so specific and historical that I don't get them. Like, I don't really understand some of the like really inside lates. Like in that opening monologue, there's like Billy Carter jokes. I'm like, what? So, but like I'm having to put them together. I'm like, Jimmy Carter had a brother who was dumb, and that was a thing that late night hosts made fun of. I guess news to me. Like, but I get it, and it. Like, I like that I don't get those jokes. I feel like it's well-researched, it's authentic, and it actually, like, helps build the reality, I think, of the world.
I completely agree with that. Let's go to another piece. What do you got next?
Okay, let's do another smart one.
Mm.
And I'll just get progressively dumber with my picks.
Yes,
my other one that I really feel good about is Jordan Peele's Nope, which is, I think, it's so recent that it almost doesn't feel like this could have been a touchstone in some ways, because I bet they wrote the script before Nope was out. But there's so much going on, I think, in Jordan Peele's Nope that resembles thematically what they're dealing with in Late Night with the Devil. So the first thing is that one of the sort of threads of Nope is these flashbacks to this multicam sitcom, Gordy's Home, where this horrible tragedy happened that ended the show, right? And so we get lots of these like, look how corny and cheesy this sitcom was, right? As a mechanism for like building suspense towards, we know something horrible is coming on the set in front of a live studio audience, right? And that's sort of like the whole like boiling pot of Late Night with the Devil. And it's one piece of Nope, but some of the humor then in the like, this is so cheesy and silly. And I think Desmalchian is just incredible in this role as being like, as so effortlessly being this late night host. But it feels like so authentically kind of corny, which just makes you wait for what the horror is happening. And that's what it feels like in a bunch of Nope. The second element in Nope that I feel like is really prevalent in this movie is, Steven Yeun's character, Jupe, in that movie is the boy who's a survivor of that multicam grown up later becomes this kind of showman who is hell bent on sort of thinking himself as a savior and special, and he's going to do this thing that no one's ever done before and prove the existence of something supernatural or alien. And that ambition almost feels like a deal with the devil. Almost, there's something I think similar about that character and Jack Delroy in this movie, where it's a little bit like, you're going to get what you want, but you're going to be destroyed by it.
Yeah.
Right? In the sort of same context of like, he's a showman and he is, you know, he has his own like amusement park or whatever, Jupiter's Claim.
Sure. Absolutely. That's a great one. And yeah, I mean, like you said, it's, you know, so recent that it's probably being made at the same time. So yeah. I'm just going to jump right on top with another one that is probably too recent and deals with, funnily enough, a lot of the same ideas there. And that is Deadstream, which is another kind of found footage like Shudder original. This is a comedy, like a full-fledged comedy, not just like kind of dark comedy, from Joseph Winter and Vanessa Winter, and stars Joseph Winter, about this guy who's just like a real kind of schmuck of a you know, YouTube streamer who he's been recently canceled or something, and decides to try to get his followers back to spend the night with his live stream equipment in a haunted house. And it goes as terribly as you can imagine.
Sure.
And you root against him the whole time. You don't really root against David Desmalchian because he's just so damn likable. But at the same time, there is some element to him where you can't tell, like, is this guy worthy of my liking him, or is he kind of, you know, a shit who's just, you know, using people to, you know, raise up in the ranks and all that. Like you were saying about the character in Nope, you know, he is just hell-bent on, you know, getting that number one spot in the late night world. And so him, the Steven Yeun character, and this main character in Deadstream all are just so hell-bent on that success of their particular, you know, visual medium, you know, of entertainment, that they don't care about anything else and, you know, any deals with the devil that they might have made along the way. And there also, Deadstream is a fun, unique way to do found footage, which at its core, Late Night with the Devil, you know, having this whole setup of being a late night show that was recorded and it actually happened at the time, even though we do break that sometimes with these backstage scenes, you know, it is at its core a found footage movie for the most part. And so both that and Deadstream, they do found footage, which is kind of a done to death genre within horror. They do it in a unique way, and I appreciate that about it too. But yeah, Deadstream, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is so funny, and I love that one.
Well, that's cool. I'll check that one out. I do think that this movie is like, it feels like a really fresh take on a bunch of things that have been done to death, like recombined, right? Mm-hmm. And the found footage is one of them, where it's like, it plays so fast and loose with the fact that it's found footage. It's like, this is found footage. And then there's like whole sections of it that are clearly not.
Yeah.
Right. But I think that that's like fine and it works because we know and we get it. And I think it would immediately get tiresome if it was like they had to think of some reason some camera was still rolling or whatever. And it was like, nobody wants that. You know what I mean? Like, so it feels like we're at a place in the found footage horror subgenre where I think we're all cool with it being like, okay, we'll use some of the found footage. We don't have to stick to that, you know?
Yeah. And we've already like established, like you had mentioned earlier, that because of the possession aspect of all this, like, you can't quite trust what's on film anyway within the movie.
Yeah.
So like, it's its own new layer of found footage, which definitely adds a lot to it. But let's go to another puzzle piece. What do you got next?
Okay, so this is interesting. It's sort of a tweak on it and going in a different direction. But my next one is Birdman, the Inarritu film. Or what's the full title? Or Birdman or the Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Oh, you got it all. I wouldn't have gotten it, but
I had to look it up last night to be like, what's the full title? Because I was like, there's something about this that feels like that's a movie where, you know, Michael Keaton is playing this character who's sort of depressed and feeling like he's washed up in his career, but it's also a little bit about the ambition of this like showman. And the thing that really makes it feel like, I feel like there's a piece that's important here, is the mono location aspect of this movie, where it's all about this one singular performance on a stage. And so I was trying to think of, because there's a lot of movies that are sort of like, just one, you know, that are almost in real time, whether they're found footage or not. And Birdman, of course, is like a really notable version of that. And just the way that that film sort of weaves between the stage and the and so much time that's spent backstage as he's trying to like do this shit while he's also hallucinating Birdman, mm-hmm. right? Felt, I don't know, there felt like there was something of a piece there where this film sort of, you know, picked up in a little bit of that sense of like this character who's falling apart backstage, trying to keep it together, front stage, and then compacting that into something that feels like it's all one real time sort of, you know, kettle that's going to explode.
Absolutely. It was one that I was thinking about as well. And yeah, I mean, there's that anxiety involved with just knowing that this guy is just on his last string, basically. He's had so much bad happen to him in the past. We get little glimpses of that. We know the stress and pressure that he's under, and we know that kind of anything can happen, because in the sense of Birdman, it's more of a surreal thing. In the sense of this, it's a horror demon possession thing, so really anything can happen. And so we just don't know how it's all going to fall apart at any moment. And so, yeah, I think that's a good one to include here. I will kind of combine two things here, because I'm going to go with Joker for my next puzzle piece here. As far as that whole climactic scene in Joker when the Joker finally gets on the Robert De Niro late night show that he wanted to be on so bad. It's, you know, obviously like a Johnny Carson type thing, and everything just goes terribly and of course explodes into amazing violence. And bring up the King of Comedy as well, as far as, you know, these kind of late night set shows, which was, of course, the biggest influence on Joker itself. So that's why I wanted to combine them here. But, you know, both of them center around that world, this idea of somebody who is just, they feel like they deserve that spotlight. They feel like they should be the one on camera. They should be in the spotlight. And, you know, do they deserve it? You know, that's questionable. Although I would say, you know, Jack Delroy is pretty fun to watch. You know, he could probably pull it off, you know, if all this shit hadn't happened, he'd probably be a success. But, you know, with the other ones, everything goes very badly. And this one, everything goes very badly. But Joker, you know, that whole sequence, it's kind of, I mean, not everybody liked Joker. To me, I really liked it, especially because of how electrifying that scene was, where you just know this is not going to go well, and you don't even ever expect it's going to go that badly, but it does, and it's something when it does.
Yeah, I think that that's right on with, like, again, the sort of lightness, the juxtaposition of the lightness of the, like, late night, which has to, it has this, like, weird, dark edge, because people can be sort of, like, mean and feel like, but it's like that big fake smile feels like it's mm-hmm. like important, right? And then just knowing something horrible is coming. And I think Late Night with the Devil is really effective in, like, you know it's all going so bad by the end of this movie, and like you're just waiting to see how, when and how that's going to drop. And it does keep you sort of like, I don't think it's very unpredictable. I think you know it's going bad, but you're like, there's a lot of different ways that this could go bad, and I'm excited to see how it does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What do you got next?
Okay, so the next is, like, I wanted to include, there, I feel like David Lynch has got to be on the list of puzzle pieces for this film. And so I went back and forth on a lot of different possibilities, like Eraserhead, which is actually, I think it came out the year that this is set. So it feels like there was 77, right? So, like, especially with the, like, weird deformed baby in Eraserhead kind of is like the weird worm puppet thing that we see a couple times in this movie. But ultimately, I'm going for my Lynch puzzle piece. I'm going to do Twin Peaks. And the reason is, besides demonic possession being sort of like the always in the background of Twin Peaks, like on Twin Peaks, there was always this sense, and it's like Lynch at his most, let's say the first season of Twin Peaks was Lynch at his most, like, it's not going to, the entire narrative is not going to totally devolve. It's not going to just turn into some expression of his dreams or whatever. It really is like we're following a very coherent, pretty much linear story that is also, like, really funny and really inventively playing with genre. And I feel like that's a lot of what this movie is doing, is like, it's sort of keeping on our toes, like, what kind of horror is this about to be? Is it a supernatural horror? Is this going to be something where it's all in his head and there's murders? Like, and it's a movie that manages to get, like, kind of have its cake and eat its too and have
it does,
all of those.
Yeah.
The other thing that makes me feel like there's like an overt nod to Twin Peaks is that like the iconography of owls is like goes throughout as is one of the motifs of Twin Peaks where it's, you know, the owls are not what they seem. And it's like this big sort of, there's like this weird connection between demonic possession and Bob and owls are the expression of that. And in this in Late Night with the Devil, not only is the show called Night Owls, but then we see that the owls are the sort of like iconography of the Grove, which is a, I think, a, as thinly veiled an allusion to the Bohemian Grove as you could come up with. Right. But this sort of the, that's the, there's like this owl mask seems to be the sort of high priest of the Grove, and they have these little toy owls that are sort of the statues and sort of connecting owls, Satanism, and the show. And that's like, that seems to be this important, like, you know, there's owls on all those interstitial, I guess, AI created cards or whatever. Yeah. But that just felt like to me, I was like, as soon as I saw owls in a couple different places, I was like, oh, this is doing Twin Peaks a little bit.
Yeah. Prompt Twin Peaks esque late night show, you know, interstitial cards. That's
And there's also just something about like the timelessness of Twin Peaks and the slicked back hair and the feeling very period and the like, it you know, and it's a. I felt it was pretty Twin Peaksy. Besides the fact that wasn't David Dastmalchian also in the reboot of or the third season of Twin Peaks?
I actually haven't seen it, so yeah, I haven't seen it. But yeah, he seems like he would fit in that world. So that's
he feels like a character that David Lynch invented in some
ways.
Yeah,
he really does.
Like, so I that was like throughout my mind, I was like, there's a lot of Lynch happening here.
I like it. I'm going to go with a little one here. I was thinking of the show Comedy Bang Bang.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I just, that first of all, the 70s set talk show, you know, obviously is how they set up that whole show, which for anyone who hasn't seen it, Scott Aukerman just creates this talk show situation where literally anything could happen at any moment. And it's, of course, not horror, it's comedy. It's just like absurdist comedy. But the idea of like this is exactly like lovingly like a 70s talk show, except for it's not whenever we want it to be, because it could be anything. And that's something we've talked about in some of these other pieces as well, that because it's the horror setting, you know, anything could happen because it's demonic possession. You can't trust what you're seeing. But, you know, just the idea of recreating it just to mess with it. I was thinking of Comedy Bang Bang.
Cool.
Such a fun show. What do you got next?
God, last look, I went back and forth, but I just feel like and maybe this is what you're saving in the bag too. It's because it's so obvious, but it needs to be pointed out that you can't talk about this movie without talking about The Exorcist, because it's not just in the Lily character as this, like, the, she's this little girl that's possessed by the devil, which feels like it's so doing an Exorcist that it's like aware of the Exorcist. And it's almost like, the characters in this show exist in a world where The Exorcist came out a few years ago, right? Like,
that's true, yeah.
So are they thinking about The Exorcist? But then also just like the sort of interesting way that Christu is like first taken over, and then that like spawns this like the spitting of the black bloody bile or whatever, the demon within or whatever. It just feels like between the 70s setting and the fact of it being a little girl possessed by the devil. I mean, the pitch for this movie feels like it's The Exorcist on a late night talk show, right?
And exactly.
So I feel like we can't not talk about The Exorcist here.
Absolutely. And like, shout out to that actress, Ingrid Torelli. I think she is so great. You know, at first playing this kind of glazed eye cult girl, you know, and then eventually turning, you know, full on possessed and creepy as shit. I think she's awesome. I was thinking The Exorcist. I was also thinking Evil Dead. She's very Deadite like in her performance once she gets totally over the top. Plus there is, you know, a lot of love for gore and just completely crazy shit. So, you know, there's some Sam Raimi in there, but yeah, The Exorcist, it has to be on the list. I completely agree with you. And she is great. She is as great as Dastmalchian is as the main lead. She's probably the second best part of this movie, I thought. So
I agree 100% on that. It's a role that would be so easy to overdo, you know, like, because it's like been done, the evil little, there was literally a trailer right before this for Abigail, which is another one of these, like, I guess she's a vampire or whatever, but it's the same, you know what I mean? Like, she has to be able to like look totally innocent and sweet and then be like the scariest thing in the movie, right? Like,
yeah.
And so, and it's so easy to potentially make that like too creepy or over the top or whatever. Or so I think that the that performance really threads that needle very well.
Absolutely. Well, I've got one more, and that is 1975's Network. You know, again, we're talking about this recreation of the late night setting and seeing behind the scenes of how one of these shows actually works and the mental effects that, you know, constant drive, not only to be number one, which we've talked about, but also this is a taxing job for anybody, even if there's not demonic possession involved. Being a late night talk show host is just constant boom, 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 you know, 20-hour work days, like, and just the toil that has on these people. And Network really goes into that in a much more comedic way, of course, but, you know, definitely deals with the effect that trying to work and succeed in that world has on these people. And so here you see that effect on David Desmalchian's Jack Delroy, and mixed with horror, you know, of course, it becomes a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely, again, especially these movies that are from this era, there is like a real feeling of like mining that and then bringing a new take to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'll read down our list of puzzle pieces here, and then we'll get into some closing thoughts on Late Night with the Devil. We talked about Videodrome, Ghostwatch, Nope, Deadstream, Birdman, Joker and the King of Comedy, Twin Peaks, Comedy Bang Bang, The Exorcist, and I squeezed The Evil Dead in there too, and Network. You know, lot. You know, obviously we're going to get into that whole, you know, late night setting and demonic possession stuff and, you know, people kind of cracking under pressure type of movies. But other than that, though, are there any other things that you wanted to mention about Late Night with the Devil that we didn't quite get into while doing puzzle pieces?
I just appreciated, like, as primarily a screenwriter, I always really appreciate when a film like is really willing to sort of like go off the most expected story structures. And like, there's not, you know, I don't really think Desmalchian's character saves the cat at the beginning of this movie, or like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, look, there's things that there's an act one and act two and act three or whatever, but like, it keeps you on your toes because you, especially in the way that, in the second half, it starts to break down, like, what's going on. Like, I find it so refreshing right now when there's a movie that I don't know how it's going to end in the first, by the end of the first half. And I think this movie does a great job at that.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair, because that is one of the things that's exciting about watching this movie, is you know... generally where it's going, but you don't know how it's going to go there, and you don't know, you know, what the implications of really anything that you're seeing are going to be for the characters or for the story or any of it. And so yeah, that is exciting filmmaking when stuff like that happens. So yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap up Late Night with the Devil. Is there another movie you watched recently you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh my god, I would have to think about that. Besides my own, watch my movie, Hanky Panky, that's coming out soon.
That's true. That's true.
Can it be a TV show?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I've recently rediscovered, and at first I hated it, and now I'm like hooked, and it's like become my guilty pleasure. It's like 10 years old. Mozart in the Jungle, which is...
I never watched that.
It's a completely different direction.
Isn't that Jason Schwartzman's in it?
He's a minor character, and I think he was one of the... maybe a writer. He was an EP on it, I think. It's like him and Roman Coppola and a bunch of those, you know, people in that Wes Anderson-y world. But at first I was like not in, and I thought it didn't hook me. And then like I watched a few episodes, and then immediately now I'm in season three. Like it's like I'm completely sucked into the show. It's just like the performances are really good. And like Gael García Bernal is just like, I just want to watch whatever he's going to do in this. This is such a good character for him as Rodrigo, this like, you know, mate drinking hallucinatory composer who's like a Gustavo Dudamel on acid or whatever. It's great.
Nice.
It's a fun show, and like, I'm going to watch the entire thing and then be sad that it's over after four seasons.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Well, great recommendation there. Let's talk a little bit about your new movie. Tell people about it, because like, it's probably a hard one to describe, like without just being like, watch the trailer.
Yeah, and literally some people are like, this trailer tells me nothing about this movie. Like people who have seen the movie are like, go back and look at the trailer. They're like, what are you doing? Like this isn't. So it's very hard to. It's a very genre bending, silly comedy. I described it as Clue on acid, actually. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm going for on acid as my comp these days. Got murder. It's a comedy. Look, first and foremost, it's a comedy. It's a funny movie. It's an ensemble comedy, and it's just sort of. A very sort of lo-fi DIY friends making a horror movie that's, you know, I think sort of surprisingly, we hope, kind of like smart and well-intentioned and like actually trying to be good as much as we can with no money or resources. Mm-hmm. And you know, for that reason, I think it sort of stands out, I'm hoping, from like a sea of like other zero budget horror movies that are comedies that are, you know, we're swinging for the fences. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's a sci-fi Christmas romance, murder mystery. Like we're trying to do a lot of things. And it was just like a group of friends, me and my co-directed with my wife, Lindsay Hahn, who's also in the movie. We're both in the movie. And it's just like a lot of fun, I think. I hope that's what we're going for.
And, you know, not included in that description right there are a bunch of inanimate objects that get involved in the fun.
Yeah, okay, it's a movie about a talking napkin who is, let's say, aroused by having his napkin body used to clean up messes. This is his fetish. Who ends up in a sort of cosmic confrontation with an evil interdimensional top hat, voiced by the incredible Seth Green, with the fate of humanity in the balance, right? This is also an alien invasion film.
Yeah. Those are some of the most fun movies when you have so many different angles. You know, you brought up Nope earlier. Like Nope is a movie where it's like, you know, there's so many different threads going into that movie. And that is always a fun thing to see. How long have you been working on this one?
Let me put it this way. Long enough that we were almost picture locked by the time Nope came out. So it took many years to edit this. We put it together pretty quickly and then spent several years editing because it was like, well, but mostly because Lindsay and I had never edited a feature film before and had, you know, jobs, and then there was a pandemic and then we had kids, and like, so it's a sort of a spare time movie that we finally finished and like somehow have gotten across the finish line. And now it's sort of legitimized it'll be on Apple, Amazon, and Google. And everywhere else on VOD on April 19th, in time for your 420 weekend.
Amazing, amazing, awesome. And now that it's going to be out there, what are you working on, something else, or are you going to expand the Hanky Panky verse?
Yes, I'm exclusively focused on Hanky Panky 2.
Nice.
Subtitle, it's okay if you didn't see the first one. And then Hanky Panky 3, hat trick. And then a Hanky Panky prequel TV show about the young Sam, like first discovering this napkin and the travails of being like an awkward adolescent boy in high school with a talking napkin that comes when he cleans up messes. Like that is that is all in the bank.
Yeah, I'm realizing right now you've got merchandising built right into this thing. This is an amazing project.
Yeah. That was what we started with. We were like, how can we sell? We want to sell napkins that people use to wipe up messes and, I don't know, pretend that they're aliens who are trapped in the body of inanimate objects and getting off on it. It sounds so crazy. I hear myself saying this.
Right. Yeah. That's exciting.
It's a real what the fuck kind of movie.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to watching it this weekend. And Nick, thank you so much. Where can people find it? Where can people find you?
So we're just sort of like, if you look, unfortunately, Hanky Panky is also the name of, it turns out, a popular underwear company. That makes sense. And so I think they're going to beat us in search engine optimization any day of the week. So HankyPankyTheMovie.com or at Hanky Panky Movie on all of the socials. Like, put movie in your search and you'll find us.
Right on. Well, Nick, thanks so much for doing the show, and hopefully we'll get you back again sometime.
Yeah, this was so much fun. Thank you.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Late Night with the Devil. Thanks to Nick Roth for joining me on that one, and thank you to all of you for listening. If you're enjoying piecing it together, make sure you're subscribed on whatever podcast app it is that you're listening to this show right now on. You could also maybe drop us a little 5-star rating or review. That would be nice. And also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. Also, don't forget to join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show. And speaking of continuing the conversation, just for a second here, you know, if you're still hanging out, listening to the outro of this episode, I'd love to continue the AI conversation too, because it's something that I keep going back and forth on. I mean, it is such a plus and minus, pro and con, you know, it's all over the place, this conversation. You know, I've dabbled a little bit. Obviously, I have some automation software, which technically, I mean, it's doing the same thing as AI, although it's the more assistive AI when it comes to mastering my podcasting or music and stuff like that. Then as far as generative AI, I mean, I've used some of it with some of my music-related stuff, whether it's some visuals for some of the, you know, YouTube videos or artwork, stuff like that. I also, of course, hire artists when I can. But it's such a, you know, hot topic right now, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I'm currently working with a filmmaker who his entire medium is AI, and so it's really exciting to see what he's going to come up with. But then there's, you know, the questions of how that artwork is generated to create it, even though it's his creativity. You know, whose art is it being trained off of? There's so many questions involved. So, hey, get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. You know, we could talk in the Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces group. You could email me, hit me up on social media at PiecingPod. I love talking about this stuff. I'm, you know, a nerd, of course. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten into doing podcasting and making music and all this stuff. So I love hearing from people. So do, in fact, get in touch with me. But yeah, that does it for today's episode. I'm going to close this out with a piece of music, as I always do. And let's see, what's a good one for Late Night with the Devil? Actually, I have a really good one. I can't believe I didn't think about this before. Oh my God. This is blowing my mind right now. I should have mentioned it during the actual conversation. Of course, this is a movie that the filmmakers couldn't have possibly seen what I'm about to bring up. But last year, I released a film score called The Dissection Table, which was a score that I made for a feature film that never got completed. It never came out. And I can't believe I didn't think about this, but The Dissection Table is literally, oh my God, I wonder if Michael O'Neill, the director, knows about this. It is basically a lot of what happens in Late Night with the Devil. And I just didn't even put two and two together until I'm sitting here recording this outro. If I didn't tell you guys, if you know, were around when I put out The Dissection Table and talked about it a bunch and put the score out, the story is about a guy who he's kind of losing his grip on reality, and in the process of going crazy is making like a late night talk show. And it's definitely a little different. It's not about a late night talk show getting possessed. It's about a crazy person having a late night talk show where murders and violence and all kinds of crazy shit happens. But yeah, wow, there is a real definite connection there. But I'm going to play a track from that because it's a perfect fit. So this is a track from the score to the film that never came out because it never did get finished. But the director gave me the go-ahead to release it as a soundtrack album. So it's a piece from that. It's the title track, The Dissection Table. Hope you enjoy it. We'll be back with more Piecing It Together real soon.
an All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.